So this is chapter 3, The Wild Edge of Sorrow, Rituals of Renewal in the Sacred Work of Grief by Francis Crowell. Where there is sorrow, there is holy ground by Oscar Wilde. Over the course of our lives, grief enters our heart in many ways. If we are to acknowledge and tend our grief, it is important to become familiar with what I call the five gates of grief. Each of these doorways leads to the communal hall of grief, and each help us in understand the many ways that loss touches our hearts and souls in this life. We are all familiar with the first great gate of grief, which is the sorrow we experience with the loss of someone or something we love. The other four gates receive virtually no attention in modern society. Consequently, the grief that accumulates at these thresholds remains untouched, and we feel the growing weight of unattended sorrow. This is often misdiagnosed as depression. We are pushed down, overwhelmed by so much congested grief. The number one cause of death in this society is congestive heart failure. What is it that is congesting our hearts? Is it more than plaque buildup in the arteries, more than high levels of cholesterol? We are burdened by undigested sorrows as well. Far too many of us suffer from broken hearts that remain unattended. By understanding the grief that is held at these other gates, we may be able to compassionately meet it, and in the right setting, allow the full expression of grief to be felt and honored. The first gate. Everything we love, we will lose. I've come to have a deep faith in grief. Have come to see the ways its mood calls us back to the soul. It is, in fact, one of the voices of the soul asking us to face life's most difficult but essential teaching. Everything is a gift and nothing lasts. This is a painful truth. To accept this fact is to live on life's terms and to not worry, not try to deny the simple truth of what the Buddhists call impermanence. When we acknowledge grief, we acknowledge that everything we love, we will lose. No exceptions. Now, of course, we want to argue this point, saying that we will keep it in our hearts, the love of those who depart this earth before us, our parents, our spouse, our children, our friends, and yes, that is true. It is grief, however, that allows the heart to stay open to this love, to remember sweetly the ways these people touched our lives. It is only when we deny grief its entry into our lives that we begin to compress the breadth of our emotional experience and live shallowly. There's a poem from the 12th century that beautifully articulates this lasting truth about the risk we take when we choose to love. It's titled, For Those Who Have Died. Ile Eskira, these we remember. Tis a fearful thing to love what death can touch. To love, to hope, to dream, and oh, to lose. A thing for fools, this love, but a holy thing to love what death can touch. For your heart has lived in me, for your life has lived in me. Your laugh once lifted me, your word was a gift to me. To remember this brings painful joy. 'Tis a human thing, love, a holy thing to love what death can touch. By Judah Halevi, or Emmanuel of Rome. This startling poem goes to the very heart of what I'm saying. It's a holy thing to love what death can touch. To keep it holy, however, to keep it accessible, we must become fluent in the language and custom of grief. If we don't, our losses become great weights that drag us down, pulling us below the threshold of life and into the world of death. My grief says that I dared to love, that I allowed another to enter the very core of my being and find a home in my heart. Grief is akin to praise. It is how the soul recounts the depths of which someone has touched our lives. To love is to accept the rights of grief. One day, a young man walked into my office with a sad look on his face. He shared that he had just come back from time spent with his new love and that he had a wonderful weekend with her. He returned home, taking care of some things, fixed some dinner for himself, and then turned on his computer to look at photos of his parents and his girlfriend. And then it hit him. He said, "I realized at that moment that I'm going to lose them all." He wept those bitter tears that melt us and reduce us to the vulnerable truths we all must confront. We need these bitter tears sometimes. They're a tonic, a fortifying essence that helps us digest these difficult realities. He said he had tried his whole life to keep this truth away, but this day he welcomed the dark angel of grief, the one holding the sharp truth of impermanence. He told me he wanted his heart to stay open and to love big. This was a beautiful moment, a life-changing moment for this young man, forged by the fierce beauty of loss. It is the bittersweet embrace of love and loss that sharpens our appreciation for those we love. Staying open to this vulnerable truth is challenging, especially in a culture that keeps pushing grief to the margins. Sometimes, however, we cannot deny this guest at the door. I remember being in New York City less than a month after the World Trade Center towers were destroyed in 2001. My son was going to college there, and this tragedy occurred shortly after his first major time away from home. The two of us made our way into the city, and what I saw touched me deeply. Everywhere I went, there were grief shrines. Flowers adorning pictures of loved ones lost. There were circles of people in parks, some silent, others singing. It was clear that the soul has an elemental requirement to do this, to gather and mourn and weep and cry out in pain in order for the healing to begin. On some level, we know that this is a requirement when facing loss, but we've forgotten how to walk comfortably expressing it. Illness is another grief that we find at the first gate. Any lingering illness can activate a feeling of loss. When a prolonged sickness arrives in our life, we lament the life we once knew and enjoyed, the one brimming with vitality. We feel emptied and drained, finding little joy or motivation for the day. We may feel betrayed in our own bodies, as though we no longer have a foundation beneath us for living fully. Illness dislodges our sense of control and invulnerability. We resist, resent, argue, and protest, attempting to wrestle our lives back from this unwelcome guest. When our health deteriorates in illness, we feel diminished, whittled away by loss after loss. Carl Jung described his experience following a heart attack as a painful process of defoliation. He said, "Everything I aimed at or wished for or thought, the whole phantasmagoria of earthly existence fell away or was stripped from me. When good health feels far away, we're taken into a place where our faith in life can flicker. One woman attended a grief ritual following a double mastectomy. Her sorrow was poignant and deeply touching. She shed the tenderest tears for the loss of her body's wholeness. Another woman shared that she was facing the last few months of her life and needed to address her grief over the losses she carried from having been ill so long. The loss of work, friendships, of strength, and of dreams. Illness asks much of us. I remember one man who came to my practice following a serious heart attack. He was obviously shaken by the experience. He was a high-powered man in a position of authority, and he was anxious to return to his former status at the top of the chain of command. I sat and listened to his story over several weeks and could see how desperate he was to reclaim his former strength. One day I said to him, "I'm concerned that you're going to waste a perfectly good heart attack. You're so committed to returning to how things were. Have you stopped to consider that those were the conditions that brought about the heart attack in the first place? Your work now is to hear what your heart is telling you. Have you turned your back on many things? Love, your friendships, in your body, and your heart is filled with grief. This heart attack is telling you something. Listen." It was a difficult thing for him to do. Something radical was being asked of him. Radical comes from the Latin word for root. His heart was calling him back to deeper ground, to the root of his life. In the opening circle with cancer patients I co-led at Commonwell, I share that their illness has thrown them into a rough invitation. I'm sorry, it says into a rough initiation. All initiatory events, like those still held in living cultures, take one into an unknown and unshaped world. Here, nothing is as it was, nor is it intended to be. It is a time of shedding and ending. The familiar world is left behind, and we exist at the edge of something without shape. It is a place of radical change. In other words, the identity we had known for our entire life has just been dissolved. Illness carries us into a place of great uncertainty. Will we ever get better? Will we ever get back to where we were before we got sick? We can no longer lean on what we know for a feeling of stability. Things teeter and shake. We feel adrift on uncommon or unfamiliar seas. As in all true initiations, we fear that we will sink into the waters of death. When we are in the grips of illness, a major focus in our mind is the hope of getting back to where we were before this illness began. But we're not meant to go back. Like the man above who resisted hearing what his heart was saying, we must recognize that we have been uprooted by our cancer, our heart attack, our depression, and we have been set down on some new shore. Like any true ritual process, we are meant to come out of the experience deeply changed. Illness strips away all access, winnowing us down to the bare essentials. When the choice of denial has been stripped away, as it is an illness, we are brought face to face with our own mortal lives, our tender vulnerabilities, the wounds that linger in our hearts, the fragility of flesh, and the immensity of the soul. We are ushered into a darker night that shed an astonishing light on our deeper and more genuine shape. The old stories crafted in a mixture of childhood wounds and societal fiction slowly yield to something more generous, elastic, and responsive to the life of the soul. We begin to experience a more vivid complexity that takes us out of either world of adolescence and into an alchemy of our adult selves. Here in this more ripened place, we can see how much more we can hold, tasting both the sweet and bitter, the beautiful and the painful, all in the same moment. Everything we avoided for the sake of living in safety yields to a desire to encounter it all. We slowly recognize that no emotion is foreign to the soul, and every one of them can be welcomed as they arrived at the door. We gradually become able to embrace the full terrain of living. Kate Duff, in The Alchemy of Illness, describes her long journey with chronic fatigue syndrome and its relationship to grief. She writes, "The Indo-European root of the word cure means to sorrow for something. And I have yet to meet a sick person who doesn't deeply sorrow for something. The breakdown of a marriage, an early death in the family, or the nameless innocent slaughtered in war." What she found at the bottom of her illness was a grief that, when she could fully express it, bound her to her life and the rest of the world. As Susan Griffin noted, "At the center of all my sorrows, I felt a presence that was not mine alone." But all too often, when grief does not bind us to life, its gravity can literally pull us into the grave. Losing someone we love is acutely painful. When death comes in forms of suicide, we encounter another, oftentimes more complicated grief. We are bewildered, shocked, and angry. We feel betrayed and abandoned. Every wild and unsettled emotion courses through our bodies as we try to make sense of the senseless. It is traumatic, ripping through our hearts like shrapnel. We are left dazed. There's something particular to this loss that undoes us. It undermines the ground beneath us, turns it into quicksand. Aren't we supposed to want to live? For many of us, the choice to end one's life feels impossible to digest, and yet, in our own secret chambers, many of us have wrestled with the question whether to be or not to be. We are supposed to say yes to life. The great American positivism. And yet suicide and suicidal thoughts have touched many of us. Suicide is not a one-dimensional creature that we can get a rope around and keep corralled. It happens for many reasons, and the reasons do not settle the hearts of the ones left to struggle in the wild wake of emotions. I've sat with many people who have had someone in their lives commit suicide. One woman in her 60s was finally able to acknowledge and grieve the suicide of her mother. She had only been 2 years old at the time. All through her life, she had tried to tell herself, "That was so long ago, it really doesn't matter." But the effects of this tear in her psyche foundation, but the effects of this great tear in her psychic foundation lingered for 6 decades, making her unsure of her worth and eating away at her faith in life. It dammed her tears and made it hard for her to love. There is often a feeling of shame attached to the survivors of suicide, a hidden doubt that they might not have done enough to prevent this death. This is a doubling of the pain. Their grief is bound together with shame, making it more difficult to talk with others and get the support they need. Finding the courage to share our experience with others is an essential piece in mending this profound sorrow. When we experience the loss of someone or something that we love, other places of grief can arise from their hiding places and ask for our attention. One woman I worked with had recently suffered the death of her son. The death was sudden and unexpected. For months, she sat with grief, slowly learning how to tend it. What she began to notice during this time, however, was another tributary of grief that rose to meet the main river of tears she was experiencing. She confided that she had never been able to ask others for what she needed. She had been everybody's caretaker, making sure that everyone was okay. Now here she sat, in a state of absolute need, wrestling with the voices that were trying to silence her to ask for support for herself. These two sources of grief emerged over time, and she could begin to see the strange grace hidden within the loss of her son. Some piece of her soul could now come home. The second gate, the places that have not known love. And again, this is from the book, The Wild Edge of Sorrow, Rituals of Renewal and Sacred Work of Grief. The book is written by Frances Weller. I am sharing the book as I explore the book as well. I hope you've been enjoying it so far. And if you're just joining in, I would recommend that you go to the previous recording so that you have an understanding of the context and what I'm reading and how I got to where I am right now in the book. Okay? So I'm going to go into the second gate. It's titled The Places That Have Not Known Love. And yes, I do make mistakes. So, hey, whatever. This is not edited. This is raw and it just is what it is. Have fun. I am. Okay, so here we go. There's another entrance to grief, a second gateway, different from the gate connected to losing someone or losing something that we love. This grief occurs in places often untouched by love. These are profoundly tender places precisely because they have lived outside of kindness, compassion, warmth, or welcome. These are the places within us that have been wrapped in shame and banished to the farthest shores of our lives. We often hate these parts of ourselves, hold them in contempt, and refuse to allow them the light of day. We do not show these outcast brothers and sisters to anyone, and we thereby deny these parts of ourselves the healing of community. These neglected pieces of the soul live in utter despair. What we perceive as defective about ourselves, we also experience as loss. Whenever any portion of who we are is denied, we live in a condition of loss. The proper response to any loss is grief, but we cannot grieve for something that we feel is outside of the circle of worth. That is our predicament. We chronically sense the presence of sorrow, but we are unable to truly grieve because we feel in our body that this piece of who we are is unworthy of grief. For many years, I offered lectures on shame. But I remember that when I was first asked to give a talk on shame, I was confused. Why were they asking me to give this talk? I was certain no one would show up for the lecture. I was pretty certain that I was the only one who felt this level of shame. Well, maybe a dozen people would turn out. The first night, there were 65 people in attendance. It grew from there, with well over 100 people showing up night after night to talk about shame. I offered these talks for many years, and they were always well attended. Clearly, I was not the only one who felt the pain of shame. It was felt by many, and I came to see how we live in a society that is drenched in shame. Shame ruptures our connection with life and with our soul. It is indeed a sickness of the soul. When feelings of shame arise, we pull back from the world, avoiding contact that will cause our risk exposure. The last thing we want in times of excruciating self-consciousness is to be seen. We find ourselves avoiding the gaze of others. We become silent and withdraw in all hopes of slipping under the radar. I remember sharing with the audience that the goal of the shame-bound person was to get from birth to death without ever being an echo on the radar of life. My tombstone was going to read, "Safe at Last." Krishan Kaufman, one of the most important writers on shame, has said that shame leaves us feeling unspeakably leaves us feeling unspeakably and irreparably defective. It is unspeakable because we do not want anyone to know how we feel inside. We fear it is irreparable because we think it is not something we have done wrong. It is simply who we are. We cannot remove the stain from our core. We search and search for the defect, hoping that once found, it can be exorcised like some demon. But it lingers, remaining our entire lives anxious that it will be seen and simultaneously longing to be seen and touched with compassion. No one arrives on this earth encrusted with shame. Rather, shame settles in our bones over time, accumulating during times of neglect or violation. Every one of us has encountered times when the connection between us and the one we needed for attention and love was ruptured. I remember once when my son was 2 years old, I was in the kitchen making breakfast for him. He came running into the kitchen and joyously shouted, "Daddy, Daddy." I turned to him and abruptly shouted, "Stop it." He looked stunned and ran to his bedroom. I knew that my response had shamed him. I put the eggs down and went to his room, knelt down on the floor and looked him in his eyes, and I said, "You wanted something from me and I didn't give it to you. What is it that you want to say to me?" he said. "It felt like you didn't want to be my daddy anymore." My heart sank and I said, "No, no, we're good." "That was all mine. I'm so sorry I got angry at you like that." "We're good. We are good, and I love you." He brightened up and smiled, hugged me, and went off to play. The bridge between us had been restored. As I walked out of his room, I wondered, what would have happened if I hadn't gone in there? I remember Kaufman saying that it is always up to the adult to restore the bridge with their child. In that moment, I understood powerfully the cost to a child who had to be the one to make the rupture, I understood powerfully the cost to a child who had to be the one to make the overture of repair. If I hadn't gone in there, my son would have had to ingest his fear that I didn't want to be his father any longer. The worst part of it, however, is that he would have felt it was his fault. If he hadn't been so exuberant, so needy for my attention, I might still hold him in my heart. He would feel he had to restrain these parts of himself in the future if he was to receive my love once again. Sometime later, reflecting upon that tender moment, I recalled an experiment making rock candy at my high school chemistry class. I'm sure many of us share this memory, but for those who don't, the experiment involves taking a glass of water, tying a string to a pencil, and placing the string in water. Then slowly, we added sugar to the water, creating a solution. And nothing happens. Nothing happens. And then, when the saturation point is reached, the sugar molecules begin to crystallize around the string. I thought, this is how it is with shame. We can endure a certain amount of times when the connection is broken between us and the people we love and need. We can digest a certain volume of disappointments and criticisms. But at some point, with enough repetition, the internal stories associated with those events reach their saturation point, and the fiction crystallize into things that feel like truths. It was no part of me that didn't want to be my son's father, and yet with enough impatient outbursts and no offers of reparation, my son might have believed otherwise. Herein begins the slow, insidious process of carving up the self to fit into the world of adults. We become convinced that our joy, sadness, needs, sensuality, and so forth are the cause of unacceptability, and we are more than willing to cleave off portions of our psychic life for the sake of inclusion, even if it is provisional. We become convinced on some basic level that these pieces of who we are not good enough, that they are in fact shameful, and we banish them to the farther shore of our awareness in hopes of never hearing from them again. They become our outcast brothers and sisters. I remember going to therapy with the expressed interest in having my therapist help me rid myself of these unwanted pieces. Shame closes the heart to self-compassion. We live with an internal state that is best characterized as self-hatred. In order to loosen shame's grips on our lives, we need to make three moves. The first move is from feeling worthless to seeing ourselves as wounded. The second emerges from the first and is a shift from seeing ourselves through the lenses of contempt to one of budding compassion. And the third is moving from silence to sharing. As long as we see our suffering as evidence of worthlessness, we will not move towards our wounds with anything but judgment. A woman I worked with blamed herself for being molested when she was 10 years old. She carried that story with absolute conviction, and she hated that little girl inside of her. At the time, there had been no attentive adults in her world to tell her what happened to her was awful and wrong, that it had nothing to do with her. Fortunately, while we were working together, she had two young daughters at home who were about the same age as she had been when the violation occurred. I asked her one day to go home and look into the eyes of her daughter and notice what she saw. When she returned next week, we sat down and I asked her what she had seen. She said, innocence. I asked her if it might be possible that she too was innocent at that age and not responsible for what happened. She nodded yes and began to weep for this interior girl for the first time. This was the beginning of her healing and her return to community. For the first time, she was able to see what happened to her as a wound and not as a commentary on her worth. She was able to take in the first few breaths of compassion and began to tend this tortured inner self. From there, she was able to make the last move by sharing about her experience in the open light of community. Her shame dissolved, and she was moved to grieve for that innocent little girl. That third move we make from silence to sharing is important, but be mindful to share these vulnerable truths only with people you fully trust. As Goethe said, tell a wise person or else keep silent. This section is titled Premature Death. Much of our grief comes from having to crouch and live hidden from the gaze of others. And in that posture, we conform our exile. I hear these outcast brothers and sisters every day in my practice. Their numbers are many, and their grief encompasses every aspect of human life. For some, these outcast pieces are connected to their sexuality and bodies. For others, it is their anger or sadness, or their joy and exuberance that has been banished. For many, it is their needs that were ignored. These outcast portions of soul do not quietly languish at the edges of our awareness. They appear as addictions, depression, or anxiety calling for our attention. They appear in our dreams, in images of ghettos and prison cells. One man struggling with alcoholism had a dream that he was walking into a bar, oblivious to a beautiful woman standing there. As he entered, she shouted, "Hey, when are you going to pay attention to me?" Here was his soul calling to him, demanding that he turn and attend to his neglected life. Many of us suffer from what I call premature death. and that we have turned away from whole portions of our life. We have adapted to a pattern of ambivalence, neither in or out of life, but living in a state of suspended animation. This stance generates a strategy of caution and avoidance. I've worked with hundreds of men and women who have artfully dodged the call to engage in living with passion and conviction. As Diane Agerman wrote, "I do not want to get to the end of my life and find that I've lived just to the length of it. I want to have lived the width of it as well." Several years ago, I was leading a group of men in Southern California in a workshop on love and death. On the second day of our time together, I asked, "What is the vow your soul is waiting for you to make?" This generated intense discussion and a good deal of grief. As men recognized that this longing in their soul was something that had been denied or ignored, they spoke about their desire to be more vulnerable, to take greater risk in love, to hold a commitment to their creativity and more. This question called forth what was not being lived, the outcast, silent parts of our soul. After that, I posed the second question. What will you have to sacrifice in order to honor that vow? Once again, it became clear to them that they were holding on to strategies designed to keep them safe, living within a prescribed radius where no one could hurt them. We worked with these two questions for the remainder of the day and shared a ritual that night to honor the sacrifice that was being asked of us. Some men released their inability to speak up when they had something important to say. Others let go of their addiction to approval and praise, while others released their need to be right. When we gathered together again on Sunday morning, I had a third question for them and said, "Imagine that it is some time in the future and you are near the hour of your death. You know this. You look back on your life and see that you have honored your vow and have been able to stay true to the sacrifice you made. For what would your soul like to remember? Write your obituary. What emerged from this time in the circle was deeply moving. Here we felt the presence of what mattered most to these men: to love big, to contribute to their communities, to nurture their children, and to feed their own souls with beauty and aliveness. All of this, however, could not become possible until they stepped fully into their lives, into the rivers of their full essence, welcoming all those pieces of soul that had been banished through self-betrayal or the fear of rejection from others. It is important to look into the shadows of our lives to see who lives there, tattered, withered, hungry, and alone. Bringing these parts of soul back to the table is a central element of our work. Ending their exile means releasing the contempt we hold for these parts of who we are. It means welcoming the full range of our being and restoring our wholeness. Until then, we will continue to carry a feeling of worthlessness and brokenness. Seen from an indigenous perspective, the grief we experience at this gate is a form of soul loss, a condition that occurs when the desire for life, the feeling of being alive, becomes so blunted that death becomes appealing and depression a way of life. Every day in my practice, I encounter individuals struggling with isolation, despair, and meaninglessness. To traditional people, soul loss was, without doubt, the most dangerous condition a human being could face. It compromises our vital energy, decreases joy and compassion, diminishing our aliveness and our capacity for wonder and awe. It saps our voice and courage and ultimately erodes our desire to live. We become disenchanted and despondent. And I am going to stop there. I'll pick back up tomorrow on page 38. And I hope you enjoyed it. Have a good night. God bless you. Bye-bye. Okay, so I'm picking up on page 38 from where we left off. The idea of soul is lost and ancient. This old intuition says that the soul can fragment, be broken, break, or flee. It happens for a variety of reasons. Physical or emotional trauma, a prolonged sickness, extensive neglect and shaming, and a common modern reason, the chronic assault of a mind-numbing existence that stupefies, dulls, and renders our lives empty. For many of us, the diminishment in our soul life began in childhood. We experience what is now referred to as developmental trauma, what I call slow trauma. This trauma occurs from an experience of absence rather than from something dramatic that happened to us. It may not have been explosive events in the home, no overt acts of violence, but there were some more subtle omissions of attention and care. In those moments, when we needed to be soothed or held, the touch often didn't come, or what was offered was a partial and distracted attention. What we were granted was too thin and didn't provide us with enough substance to calm the effect of the experience we were having. I see the remnants of this trauma daily in my practice. It shows itself in the inability to regulate internal states of distress as they arise and in feelings of self-doubt and worthlessness. Gudrun Zomerlin has written about trauma as the shaking of a soul. The German word for trauma, Seelenschakrug, I just slaughtered that, but hey. The first part, Seele, means soul. Yershadring is something that shakes us out of the ordinary flow and out of our usual sense of time into an extraordinary state. Trauma, then, is a soul-shaking experience that ruptures the continuity of our lives and tosses us into an alternate existence. When this soul-shaking occurs frequently and early in life as a result of a prolonged neglect, what is originally an extraordinary state gradually becomes ordinary. It is the world as we know it, unsafe, unreliable, and frightening. This is a profound loss and a lingering sorrow that is difficult to hold. The failure of the world to offer us comfort in the face of trauma causes us to retreat from the world. We live on our heels, cautiously assessing whether it is safe to step in. We rarely feel it is. One man I work with slowly revealed how he expected less than zero from life. He deserved nothing. He had a hard time asking for salt at a restaurant. He His persistent image in therapy was of a small boy hiding behind a wall. It was not safe for him to venture into the world. He was terrified of being seen. I know because I lived this way for 40 years, weary and determined to prevent further pain by remaining on the margins of life, untouchable and seemingly safe. Here we find the agonizing convergence of trauma and shame, the failure of others to adequately attend the painful emotional experiences we have as children is translated as a reflection on our being inherently bad and outside the embrace of love. Surely if I mattered, if I were good enough, this need, this pain, would have received attention and holding by someone. Recall my son's immediate conclusion that I didn't want to be his father any longer. These ruptures in the holding space between children and caregivers are nearly impossible to hold neutrally. In this brilliant book, The Trauma of Everyday Life, psychiatrist and Buddhist scholar Mark Epstein addresses the pervasive nature of trauma. He says that trauma is inherent in being human, but when painful emotions and unpleasant feelings are not picked up and handled by the parents, the infant or child is left with overwhelming feelings that he or she is not equipped to deal with, feelings that often get turned into self-hate. Here, trauma remains a source of ongoing suffering, eating away at our worth and undermining our ability to step fully into our lives. It lingers in our soul as a primitive agony, an idea that Epstein draw from the work of British psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott. Primitive agony remains in our psyche as a gravitational field, pulling us downward towards anxiety and dread. Epstein shows us the ways out of this maze. Drawing on the teachings of Winnicott and the Buddha, both of whom stress the need of creating an internal holding environment that resembles that of a caring and attentive mother, mindfulness becomes the soft place within the agony of our losses, within which the agony of our losses can be healed. It is an approach of reverence, of compassion, granting us a spaciousness that helps to untangle the knots in our soul. This is the core of my work and my practice. This approach reminds us of the importance of remaining in our adult selves when working with grief states. The adult is the only one who can offer this holding space for our sorrows, pains, and sufferings. It is too easy for the child self to get pulled into his or her primitive agony in disassociated parts or complexes when sorrow knocks on the door. Turning towards the suffering and into its marrow of our grief with the attention and attunement of a caring adult helps to dilute and transmute the trauma and shame into the kind of sensitivity that can inform our compassion for others, There are times, however, when the caring presence comes from outside of ourselves. The community can be the holding space for most of our painful stories. I remember a young woman in her early 20s who attended a grief ritual in Washington. Over the course of the three days that we worked to turn over our grief and compost those pieces into fertile soil, she continuously cried quietly to herself. I worked with her individually for some time and heard her lamentations over her worthlessness through gasps and tears. When it was time for the ritual, She rushed to the shrine. I could hear her crying out over the drums. I am worthless and am not good enough. And as she wept and wept, all within the container of the community, in the presence of witnesses, alongside others deep in the process of releasing their grief. When it was over, she shone like a star. She had finally realized how wrong the stories about her worthlessness were, and how precious were these pieces of her essential self. A brief note on blame. Having worked with people for more than 30 years in my practice, it is clear to me that finding a target to blame is effortless. Nothing is asked of us when we simply assign fault to someone else for the suffering we are experiencing. Psychology has colluded in the blame game, pointing an accusing finger at our parents, while many of us suffered mightily because of unconscious parenting. We must remember that our parents were participants in the society that failed to offer them what they needed in order to become solid individuals and good parents. They needed a village around them, and so did we. Of course, we were disappointed with our parents. We expected 40 pairs of eyes greeting us in the morning, and all we got was one or two pair looking back at us. We needed the full range of masculine and feminine expressions to surround us and grant us a knowledge of how these potencies move in the world. We need to have many hands holding us and offering us the attention that one beleaguered human being couldn't possibly offer consistently. It is to our deep grief that the village did not appear. Archetypal psychologist James Hillman offers an image that speaks to the work of bringing these rejected aspects of soul back from the wasteland. The alchemist had an excellent image for the transformation of the suffering and symptoms into the value of soul. A goal of alchemical process was the pearl of great price. Let me start that over. The alchemist had an excellent image for the transformation of suffering and symptom into a value of soul. The goal of alchemical process was the pearl of great price. The pearl starts off as a bit of grit, a neurotic symptom or complaint, a bothersome irritant in one's secret inside flesh, with no defensive shell can protect oneself from. This is coated over, worked at day in and day out, until the grit, one day, is a pearl. Yet it still must be fished up from the depths and pried loose. Then, when the grit is redeemed, it is worn. It must be worn on the warm skin to keep its luster. The redeemed complex, which once caused suffering, is exposed to public view as a virtue. The esoteric treasure gained through cult work becomes an exoteric splendor. To get rid of the symptom means to get rid of the chance to gain what may one day be of greatest value, even if at first an unbearable irritant, lowly in disgust, in disguise. It is in the inferior parts of our lives that we find redemption. This is, however, hard for us to accept in a culture driven by demand for perfection. Still, it is in the outcast, those parts of us that we have sent to the edges of awareness, that we will recover our true humanity. It is within our secret inside flesh that we will touch our weakness, inadequacy, failure, dependency, and the host of experiences that undermine our culture, our culture's heroic ideal. This is where we find our healing. The least of our brothers and sisters are the ones that require us to reveal our wounds. In doing so, we are free from the obsession with measuring up and getting it right. And it is through grieving for these despised pieces of life that we restore our humanity. It is here that we begin to recover the unlived life. David White offers a beautiful poem on the way we are invited to welcome back the outcast parts of our being. This stanza from Coleman's Bed is filled with self-compassion, and it goes like this. And so it is. Be taught now among the trees and rocks how the discarded is woven into shelter. Learn the way things hidden and unspoken slowly proclaim their voice in the world. Find that inward symmetry to all outward appearances. Apprentice yourself to yourself. Begin to welcome back all you sent away. Be a new annunciation. Make yourself a door through which to be hospitable, even to the stranger in you. His imagery is generous, inviting us to approach the fragments of our life with curiosity and humility. He then offers a surprising revelation. Every part of us longs to reveal its voice to the world. We must welcome back all we have sent away, and in doing so, become a new annunciation. Imagine seeing ourselves this way. What a wild and freeing image, like Gabriel and Mary in the secret conversation about what is most holy. Invite them in, feed them, and be hospitable. Regrets are another part of the second gate. Those choices we made that hinder or harmed ourselves or others, the unlived life of abandoned dreams, friendships that withered and died, or the decision to withdraw our hearts from the world and neither receive nor offer love. These things we regret are sources of deep and abiding loss. To live with regret is a heavy sadness. It is like walking through a graveyard of loss. Regrets require a soft hand of self-compassion. It's easy for us to judge and shame ourselves relentlessly for past mistakes. We chew these bones over and over in the vain hope that some new perspective might arise, freeing us from the sorrow attached to our actions. That we won't help. That won't help. Instead, what is asked of us in the quiet terrain of our inner conversation is to hold these regrets with gentleness, acknowledging who we were at the time we made those choices. What part of us might have come to the foreground of our life in that particular moment? Kindness and mercy are soothing medicines in the room of regret. Forgiveness cannot be willed. We can, however, create the condition within the grace of forgiveness with which grace of forgiveness can arise. When our regrets are polished by self-compassion, they soften and release the life trapped inside. Sometimes the grief we carry for these lost pieces of soul comes out in the language of outrage. Many of us were taught to be nice boys and girls, to not speak up when we are injured or shamed. Those of us carrying this oppressive weight need the support of the community to encourage us to find our voice, to speak out against the internalized silencing. During our grief rituals, we use writing practices that help to free the voice that yearns to tell the truth. One of our practices include that we can call protest shuttles, phrases that grant us permission to enter the forbidden territories of resistance and outrage. Some participants find the phrase, it's not all right with me, to be liberating. Others, I would not shut up, or I would not live small. Sometimes the simple enough does the work. Each of these offerings encourages the long-held grief around these rejected parts to rise and put to an end their exile. It is important to remember that grief does not appear solely through tears. It is also expressed through our anger and outrage. Through acknowledging our grief, we begin the process of being made whole again. We held a grief ritual shortly after the 9/11 attacks. Many stories of violence and violation were being evoked by the tragedy. As we listened to the intensity of the stories, we realized the need to offer a secondary shrine for this event. The normal shrine at these rituals is a water shrine. Water is the element of healing and renewal in many traditions. On this occasion, however, the element of fire was also being called in. Fire is the energy of passion and ignition, and it is often associated with the ancestors. People needed an energy field large enough to fully receive their protests. The site where we were holding this ritual had an immense old fireplace in it. At one end of the room, we created our water shrine, and at the other, surrounding the fireplace, we built the second shrine. Once the ritual began, people spent time weeping at the water shrine and shouting their outrage to the fire. Many of them migrated back and forth from shrine to shrine. At times, rage would trigger tears, and at others, tears would evoke rage. Grief is a powerful solvent, capable of softening the hardest of places in our hearts. When we can truly weep for ourselves, when we can truly reap for ourselves in those places of shame, we have invited the first soothing waters of healing to wash through our souls. Grieving, by its very nature, confirms worth. I am worth crying over. My losses matter. I can still feel the grace that came when I truly allowed myself to grieve all of my own losses connected to a life filled with shame. Pisha Gertler speaks beautifully of compassion of a heart opened by grief. This poem is titled The Healing Time. Finally, on my way to yes, I bumped into all the places where I said no to my life. All the unattended wounds and red and purple scars. Those hieroglyphs of pain carved into my skin and bones. Those coded messages that sent me down the wrong street again and again. Where I find them, the old wounds. The old misdirections, and I lift them one by one close to my heart, and I say, holy, holy. And I will conclude there. And next reading will pick up on page 46, the third gate, the sorrow of the world. And I will continue to read that the next time I come back. Again, fun for me, I would say. Definitely being able to continue on this journey. And I hope you enjoy it as well. If you have any questions, please feel free to ask anything you'd like to share. Please share. And until next time, have fun, live life, be blessed, and don't forget to just be human.